Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 154 of the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Now this week we're talking about the 911, as we are going to be a handful of times throughout this year, because in September Porsche will celebrate the 60th anniversary of the 911, so it's a big year for the 911. And we're going to be talking about the history of the car as we get closer to that date in September. This week, we're starting with the early tale of the 911, how the 911 came to be, and some of the most special air-cooled variants of the 911. There's some really good stuff to get stuck into there. A little bit later on, we're doing What Goes Up, which is where we have a look at the market, see what's going on in the market. But before that, we're talking all about air-cooled 911s. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. This is the first in, I think, what's going to be three episodes this year, Andrew, between now and September, in which we discuss in some detail the Porsche 911, and hopefully tell, I mean, you can't tell the full story of that car, can you? But, you know, kind of from start to finish, explain how it came to be, and discuss its significance. And so with this episode, we're talking about the very early days of the 911, and indeed the years preceding the 911.
Yeah, and the point being is that in September 1963, Porsche showed a new car called the 901, and it became the most successful sports car in history, easily. Hmm.
I suppose ultimately it's how did that happen? That's the point of these episodes, isn't it?
How did that happen? How did it get from there to, you know, 60 years later to where we are today, when, you know, the 911 has been such a staple of, you know, even if you've never been in one, you know, let alone driven one, let alone owned one, everybody knows about the 911, don't they? It is, you know, it is the one sports car. It's possibly the one car that anybody who professed to be any kind of enthusiast would think that they knew quite a bit about. So I guess one of the purposes of this is to just do a slightly deeper dive, isn't it, into how it came about and how it evolved, try to explode some myths about it, try to hopefully say some stuff which not everybody knows, and to celebrate 60 years of this most extraordinary motor car.
There is something about a 911 that people generally understand. They get it. You know, they might not have any interest in cars at all, but in my line of work, people will often say to me, "So, what's the best car you've ever driven?" And I mean, the real answer to that is probably Maserati MC12 Course, the track only one, because it was fantastic and I loved it. But the answer I tend to give is Porsche 911. And if people really don't understand much about cars, they'll go, "Oh, I've heard of that. That's a good one, isn't it?" And if they dig a bit deeper, I can go, "Oh, but maybe it's a 911 GT3, the more hardcore one." And then if it turns out they really love their cars, I can go, "Okay, well, it's a 911 GT3 RS 9972. And then and then you've given them an answer that satisfies their inner geek. But it just has this sort of broad appeal or at least understanding that I don't think many other cars have.
I think what is most, well, one of the things we'll talk about today is that Howard design, as flawed as it was when it came out in 1963, you know, it survived at all.
Yeah.
Let alone longer than any other sports car in history. Let alone that it went on to do, I mean, in competition, which I'm not talking about today, that's another podcast all by itself. It did everything.
Mm.
You know, 911s and its derivatives won everything from, you know, the Monte Carlo Rally to Le Mans.
Mm.
And with a bit of Paris-Dakar chucked in there too.
Amazing.
And it's been, you know, they are variously, you know, some of the most exhilarating sporting cars you could possibly imagine driving. You know, a modern GT3 RS is just ridiculous. But at the same time, they are also just the most usable daily hacks, aren't they?
Mm.
And, you know, lots of people just choose to go about their business in a, you know, a nicely spec'd Carrera.
Yep.
And that's what they drive. You know, there's never been a car with anything like the breadth or depth of achievement over anything like that period of time in the 911. So,
the versatility is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, am I right in saying, you're going to tell me I'm wrong, but am I right in saying that our very first podcast, 150-something episodes ago, which must be getting on for 3 years now, was a 911 episode?
And I think it was number two.
Okay. But we haven't been back since, so no. I think it's been, you know, more than long enough. So, yeah, let's get on with it.
Let's do it. So this is the first one, right? And we're talking about how Porsche got from the 356 to the 911. How did that happen? And so, I mean, we have to wind the clock all the way back probably to the, I don't know, maybe the early 1950s when Porsche was building this tiny little thing called the 356. And actually, if you look at a 356 coupe, you can see where the design inspiration for the 901, the original 911, came from, can't you? Because the silhouette is still there. The cannon tubes, they call them, the headlights, the raised arches are still there.
Yeah, yeah, they are. But I don't think, I mean, because I think people think, well, yeah, 356 was, you know, a rear engine car powered by a flat formation air cooled engine.
Mm.
So was the 911. So they must, one must have somehow kind of evolved out of the other.
Mm.
It absolutely didn't. You know, I think one of the most amazing things about the 911 is that when they sat down to do it, you know, let's not forget that when they started, you know, thinking hard, I mean, they started thinking about replacing the 356 in as early as 1952. But when they started really thinking about it in the late 50s, Porsche was only a 10-year-old company.
Yeah.
And the ambition behind it was so great. Basically, what they decided to do was an entirely new car. We'll get into this from end to end. You know, body, engine, suspension, everything that is, you know, identifiable to you and me as being, you know, part of the major makeup of a car. They changed it, and what they wanted to do was to drive their brand up market. And you know, I think they thought the 356 was a nice car in which to practice in. And they felt they'd done that. And, you know, let's not forget that in the 1950s, while they were, you know, coming up with these ideas, they'd become an immensely successful racing team as well. Mm. You know, they hadn't won anything big because they didn't compete at the top level in terms of, you know, trying to compete for outright wins at Le Mans. But they'd already been on the podium at Le Mans. They were already the sort of go-to guys if you wanted to go and win a, you know, 1600cc class in something. You know, they'd, but you know, by the early 60s, you know, they were doing Formula One. They were, you know, the company had come a huge distance in a short period of time. And they thought, well, you know, we're ready now. Let's do something really, really big. Let's do something unlike anything else we've ever done before. And the astonishing thing is, they kind of cocked it up. I'm going to get into this because, you know, a 901. I think everybody knows the story about how the 901 became the 911 because Peugeot objected because they trademarked all three-digit numbers with a zero in the middle. It was a properly flawed car. It was, it had so many problems, and yet somehow it survived, and it's an extraordinary story.
So I think let's talk a little bit about the 356 and what its limitations were and why Porsche couldn't just evolve that basic design.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tiny little thing, isn't it? It's got A little diddy four-cylinder flat engine with, what, 90 horsepower or something? Not a great deal of power.
At the most. At the most. You know, that's what a sort of 356 B or C would have, you know, at the top level. I think the base engine, even quite late on in its career, had 60 horsepower. And in fact, one of the design specifications for the new engine, which the engine which eventually, not the engine that they originally designed for the 911, but the engine that eventually went into it, was that it should have over double the power of that engine, of that 60 horsepower engine, but the same mechanical refinement. That's how ambitious they were being. And the one thing you could say about the 60 horsepower 356 is that it was a really mechanically refined car, and that's what they were looking at. So 90 horsepower at the most. And that engine actually did go into the 911 in what they called the 912 as the sort of budget special. As you say, it was a flat four air-cooled engine derived from the engine. I mean, probably with no parts in common anymore, but still derived from the engine of the Bean and the Beetle.
And that's just the engine, isn't it? The suspension architecture was a severe limitation as well for that car.
Yeah, and also, you know, Beetle derived. You know, you had this trailing link front suspension, you had swing axles at the back. And, you know, one of the things that Porsche, well, they recognised it in stages. They knew from the start that the front suspension had to go, and they twigged after a few false attempts that the rear suspension had to go too. So, you know, ask anybody today, ask anybody who knows about engineering what designing a suspension system is like. Then say, just imagine designing two completely different suspension systems, one for the front, one for the back, neither of which is a type you've ever done before.
That's a challenge.
That's what they did. And surprise, surprise, it didn't work out. You know, it wasn't perfect from the off.
So there were lots of, I think there were several prototypes, weren't there, in this phase during the late 50s, perhaps into the 60s, that Porsche experimented with. Just trying to, as you've written a story that went up last week, actually, on the app and website, about this era at Porsche. And you say the line you use is as Porsche groped its way towards the original 911. So, I mean, it wasn't obvious, was it, that it should look the way it did, that it should have the engine it did, that it should have the suspension it did? All that stuff had to be figured out over time.
Yeah, and through a process of trial and error. And as the story I wrote goes into the car they came up with, in fact, they came up with quite a few different concepts, but the car they pursued the furthest was actually this concept. It was very different to a 911. It was even more different to a 356. It was what they described at the time as a full four-seater.
And you only need to look at the 695. It has several other names. It could also be the 754, the 754 T7, the Type 7, and the T7.
Yeah.
But this is a prototype. Was it very late 50s, or did it spill into the 60s?
Both. Yeah, so it started in the late 50s, and I think they killed it in about 61.
And so the point about this car is that it has a six-cylinder flat air-cooled engine out the back behind the rear axle line. It has, from the forward of the A-pillars, it looks like an early 911, doesn't it? Like an original 911.
It does. And it has the McPherson strut front suspension. The reason that they did the McPherson strut front suspension was, a couple of reasons that they use it to this day on every hatchback, in that it's cheap. And it's easy to tune, but really they did it for luggage space. There was a perception that whatever this car was, it had to be able to take a set of golf clubs in the nose. And so that's why they did it. That's why they threw away. And it was such a departure, because if you look at the sort of front suspension that a 356 had, in its concept, it's the same front suspension that an Auto Union race car had in the 1930s, designed by Ferdinand Porsche. And that's what they'd done, apart from some of their 50s racing cars. But in terms of, you know, all the 356s, they all just followed traditional Porsche thinking. And that all went out the window.
And actually, talking of McPherson struts, only now, or in the last couple of years, can you buy a 911 that doesn't have a McPherson strut at the front.
Current generation GT3. I mean, and most of them, the vast majority still do.
Yeah, it's amazing,
unless you buy
a
GT3 or a GT3 RS, you're still getting a strut.
Yeah, it is incredible. Yeah. So the key thing about this 695 and all its other various names is that it doesn't have that traditional recognisable 911 silhouette, that sweeping roof line that goes down to the rear of the car. It has a longer roof and then a bit of a step at the rear screen.
Yeah, and a much taller roof too.
Yeah, the point being it should accommodate adults in the back seats.
Yeah.
And as we well know, adults in the backseat of a 911, it's not really going to work, is it? Unless you're happy to be extremely uncomfortable, then it's a very short journey.
Or you're absolutely desperate.
Yeah, well, quite. And so, but for a while, Porsche was considering making its new sports car a full four-seater.
And the reason for that, if you think about, you know, Porsche, by the end of the 1950s, you know, they were getting into a bit of stick because, you know, cars like, you know, Jaguars, you know, Mark IIs, that sort of thing, which were full-seaters, but which, you know, it came with a 3.8-litre engine with 200 and something horsepower. Blow the doors off a 3.5. Even a Citroën DS, you don't think of as being a sporting car, would easily outpace a 3.56. You know, and these were, you know, these were big four-seat cars. And so I think that's probably the direction of travel that they were going in until Ferry Porsche suddenly thought, well, hang on a second. And he did later go on to say, if we'd continued with that car, which is not a direct quote, but what he, the essence of what he was saying was that if we'd continued with that car, all that would have happened is we'd have come up with the same sort of car as everybody else, but done it worse, because they knew how to do that and we didn't.
It's a crucial moment. It's a turning point in the history of the 911, that decision to not pursue a full four-seater. It would have been such a different car, and it probably wouldn't have lasted for 60 years and had this global reputation.
And the engine too. So that engine was a 2-litre air-cooled flat six. So you think, oh, well, that's clearly the engine that went into the 911. Absolutely not. They developed this engine, this 2-litre air-cooled flat six, but with push rods operating the valves. And, you know, as anybody knows anything about engines, you know, push rods, you know, come with problems. You know, particularly they limit the speed at which an engine can turn. And, you know, and if you think about how the 911 engine evolved, you know, the only way you could really get more power out of the push rod engine was just by simply making it larger. And if you think about all the 911 went on to achieve and the reputational effect of that, all the, you know, stardust that got sprinkled down on showroom 911s from 911s, you know, winning races, winning rallies and everything. They'd never have been able to do that if it had the old pushrod engine in it, because they'd never have been able to tune it. They'd never got the power out of it for it to be able to do all the things that it did. And so giving up on that and actually going, no, we're going to do this properly. We're going to do this with overhead camshafts, which means we can tune it. You know, without that too, there's no way the 911 would have survived. Or if it had, they would have had to, at some stage, done a completely different engine for it.
If you want to see what the 695 looks like, you can just Google it or get on the app or website. And there are some lovely images in the story Andrew wrote. But it has this, it looks curious. And actually, it's kind of grown on me over time. But the moment you see it, I think it just looks a bit awkward, a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It has almost, because of the way the rear roof line works, the rear screen, it has this almost boat tail type appearance.
Yes.
It's a curious thing.
Yeah.
But certainly from the front, you can it looks almost pure 911. So you're right. It's those two key decisions to design an overhead camshaft engine and to ditch the full four-seat layout, make it just a 2+2.
Yeah.
Those two things were absolutely key, weren't they? And it just means that Porsche, basically, it got the original 911 just right.
In theory. Yeah. They got the specification of the original 911 just right. Yeah. The execution was somewhat different. We should also talk about the decision to abandon swing axles. You know, again, swing axles have been around, you know, in Porsche design since the early 1930s. But they produce some... Because particularly under braking, because of the camber change, they produce some highly undesirable handling traits. And also they produced packaging problems and everything else. And so they went to a trailing arm design at the back, a semi-trailing arm design at the back, you know, which had its limitations when we think of modern multi-link suspension systems and everything else. But you know, compared to what they had before, it was, you know, it was a far superior suspension system. And again, I think if they continued with swing axles, there's no way the 911 would have survived. They're all these little pieces of the puzzle, and if any one of them hadn't fallen into place, you know, we wouldn't be recording this podcast because the 911 wouldn't have survived 60 years.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Or they might, you know, if they had put a pushrod engine in it, perhaps they'd have replaced the 911 wholesale a few years later.
Well, exactly.
And it's a different car then.
Yeah. Mm. Whereas the 911, the 901, they launched in 1963. They didn't really replace it until the 996 in 1998.
Mm. Yeah, the 993 was a bit of a sort of transition car, wasn't it? Because it was still based on, well, still the original.
Well, okay, so the 996, yeah, the 993 had a multi-link rear end.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was the first one to go away from the semi-trailing arms. But it was still, you know, it was still an air-cooled flat six. It was still absolutely a direct evolution. And, you know, the first time the 911 was replaced was with the 996. And everything, there is a direct link for evolution to evolution to evolution all the way through from 1963 to 1998. Well, yeah, until the 996, 993 went out of production. So, yeah, I mean, 35 years, one design.
So it was Ferdinand Alexander Porsche, Butzi Porsche, who was given the job of designing the original 911.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can see how the design language, as it were, evolved from the 356. There is a kind of commonality, a familiarity there. But the extraordinary thing about it is that even now, 911s are an evolution of that same appearance.
Yeah.
Even now. And it's, I suppose it's partly because it's a simple, clean, actually quite beautiful design. But it's also determined to a great degree, actually, by the packaging, by the mechanical layout of the car. You think where the engine is. You think how much space needs to be set aside for those little rear seats. You think about that low bonnet line. It's all still fundamentally the same.
Yeah, and the reason that 911s in 2023 have their engines in the back is because that's where it was in the Beetle before the war.
Yeah.
And you put it in the Beetle before the war, because, you know, it was expensive to have an engine at one end and your driven wheels at the other end. It was space inefficient too. And they hadn't figured out front wheel drive to any acceptable degree. So what did you do? And that's why so many cars, so many cheap cars, you know, Fiat 500s and you know, that sort of, stuck their engines in the back because you could tuck them away in the back. You get lots of space inside. Nobody thought about, you know, crash regulations at the time, not having an engine in front of you. And that's where it went. And that's why it's where it is today. It became, you know,
it's almost become an accident, iconic, isn't it?
It's become iconic, hasn't it? You know, the rear engine car. It defines the 911. You know, I think we probably all think you could change just about everything else, but apart, you know, as long as it's still rear engine and a flat formation engine, then it's still a 911. And the reason it had a flat formation engine and the reason it's rear engine, it basically goes back to the Beetle.
There were so many happy accidents in the gestation of the 911, and the name is another one. Porsche wanted to call it 901. You've already mentioned this. Peugeot said, and so they changed one number, and it became the 911. It was never supposed to be called 911.
No, but now it's the most famous name.
Yeah, it is better.
I mean, it just trips off the tongue better, doesn't it? 901, 911.
Yeah, it also sounds less like a Peugeot.
It sounds a lot less like a Peugeot. Yeah.
So Frankfurt Motor Show, September 1963, they unveil this thing. Now, I wonder, did the world sit up and take notice, or did it seem like a little rear-engine curio from some barely known, young car company? Do you think the competition sat up straight away and thought, now this is something? Or did it take a while for that reputation to build?
Well, I mean, I think you have to think of, you know, what that competition was. And I wonder how seriously people would have taken the 911. Jaguar had the E-Type.
Yeah.
You know, the E-Type had come out 2 years earlier.
Mm.
You know, with a twin cam 3.8 litre straight six.
Mm.
And then Porsche comes along with, as you say, this funny little car. And I think that, you know, Porsche was clearly a company which commanded an enormous amount of respect. You only had to look at what it had done in the competition, even by then, to know that these weren't, you know, a bunch of, you know, happy-go-lucky clans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But no, I don't think that, you know, in any way people looked at that car and thought, oh shit, that's the future. Mm. That's the bus and we missed it. Mm. No, I think they thought, you know, that's interesting. Porsche have replaced the 356 with a bigger, more powerful, more refined, more technically advanced car. Exactly what you'd have expected them to do, given the 356 by then had already been in production. Well, I mean, it had been sold for, you know, a dozen years by then. And so it was kind of like a logical evolution, not just for a car like the 356, but for a company like Porsche, which is still, you know, a very young company, and still trying to find its way in the world and trying to push itself up market because, you know, that's where the money was. So I think it was, pretty much what people looked. I think the 695 would have been a surprise if Porsche had gone from making this, you know, this little two and a bit seat, tiny little coupe, to a full four seater. I think that would have got people's attention, and I think they probably would have thought, well, why are they doing this? Because there's so much other stuff like that out there. But no, I think the 911 was just sort of, yeah, what they were expecting. And then I also think that once people started to experience them, I think they would have relaxed even more, because I think they probably would have thought, well, this isn't a terribly good car.
So you've been teasing this all episode. What is it then? What is it about those early 911s that didn't sit right?
Okay, so they had all sorts of problems. You know, a lot of them due to the weight, where it was, and the shape.
Yeah.
A rear engine car is going to be more aerodynamically unstable than a front engine car because its center of pressure is way ahead of its center of gravity. And obviously, with all that weight at one end, we know what happens. You know, the weight always. We've only got to play badminton. Look what happens to a shuttlecock in flight to know that the heavy bit always wants to go first. And the engine turned out to be heavier than they expected, so there was more weight in the back. You know, back then, and it's amazing to think of it, you know, the best tyre they had for it was a 165 HR tyre on a 4.5-inch rim. You know, with early 1960s rubbers, and it just wasn't up to it. Also, this was a very powerful engine. You know, 130 horsepower may not sound like much, but back then, you know, that was a lot to put in, you know, a carb weigh. I think the original cars came in at like proper DIN full tanks weight of about 1080. So a dry car would have been under a ton. The other problem they had, which I don't think they foresaw, was, you know, they did, obviously, as all car manufacturers did, they did all their testing with prototypes and they were fine. But prototypes are made to very, very fine tolerances because everything has to be perfect. And then they stuck it on a production line and those tolerances went out the window and they discovered the car was unbelievably sensitive to the way that each individual car had been set up. Yeah. And you were getting things like cars which handled in left-hand corners completely differently to how they handled in right-hand corners. And there were problems with the steering. The car, I wouldn't say it was a mess, but it was nothing like as good in reality as it appeared to be on paper, or indeed as it had been on testing. And that really is where the reputation came from. Because as you and I know, once it was properly sorted, and it did take them time, they used to do things like, without telling the customers, they realised they obviously needed more weight in the nose, but they also realised was you couldn't just put weight in the nose. It was where that weight was, and you couldn't just put it in the middle of the nose. So they did two things. They actually put weights in the bumpers at either end. They put like 25 kilos Whoa. In the front bumpers, and they called them bumper reinforcements. Safety feature, yeah? Cobblers. Absolute cobblers. It was to try and balance out the car. And they realised the weight had to be at either side of the car. Another thing they did, they went from one big battery, which is in the nose of the car, to two smaller batteries mounted at either side for exactly these reasons. So they did all this stuff to try and balance out the car. And eventually when was it, 69, so it had been around for a long time. This just tells you how long it took them to sort this out. They extended the wheelbase. Now, we know that a longer wheelbase car is a more stable car than a shorter wheelbase car. And that was one advantage. But actually, the real reason they did it, they extended the wheelbase without moving the engine. Yeah? So they put longer suspension arms in. So the back of the car went further back, but the engine stayed where it was. So it became essentially more mid-engined or less rear-engined. So the weight distribution shifted, and that's why they did it. So there were just all these things that they had to address. They had to address the production issues, you know, the tyres, they, you know, originally, a 4.5-inch rim was the widest tire you could use for 165 section tire. So, and eventually they ended up using a 5.5-inch rim. They went to a 5, and then they went to a 5.5, and then they started using 185 section tires. And over time, these problems started to resolve themselves. But anybody who thinks I've been lucky enough to drive a few, 1960s short wheelbase 911s. And with the benefit of hindsight and all this retro engineering and everything else that was done both in period and since, they're brilliant handling cars. We've probably all wasted far too much time on YouTube watching onboards of maniacs driving short wheelbase 911s around Spa, and they're sideways everywhere, and they look like the best handling cars that have ever been built. Yeah, they weren't always like that.
Mm. It's taken a lot of time to get.
It's taken
to that
a
point.
Lot of time, and if you. Got in. I mean, I can't remember how many 901s were built. I think there were like sort of 70 or 80 cars.
I think it's 82. I've got 82.
82
here.
Cars. Okay. If you got on one of those, factory fresh, you wouldn't be driving it around Spa like that. Well, you would, but for a very short period of time.
Before it rotated, I'm sure.
It's the ultimate 911 cliche, isn't it? So what is it? It's a miracle of, evolution over revolution or whatever, but it's a cliche for a reason, because that's what happened. It wasn't born that good at all.
It took time.
It was made that good over time. And I guess Porsche didn't have a choice, because it wasn't like they could just can it. They didn't have anything else. They couldn't go back to building the 356, although they did keep the 356 in production for longer than they expected to. I think 356s were still being sold in 65. Which was, a year and a bit after the 911 had been in full production. But, they couldn't go back, so they had to press on. And I think probably within the company, they realised that there was a great car trying to get out. And so they just had to go and find it. And being Porsche, being meticulous in their engineering and the way that they went about everything, they just kept on chipping away at it, changing this, changing that. And eventually, well, we know what happened.
So let's talk about some of the special air-cooled 911s. And I think probably the first one is the 1967 911R. Exceedingly rare car.
Yeah.
Have you driven one?
Yeah.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. Blimey. Yeah, I've driven the one, actually.
Go on. Oh, God. Let's have the story, then. Of the car itself and of you getting to drive the car.
So there was... someone who knows more about these things than I do is going to come and tell me how absolutely wrong I am. My understanding is that... they made one aluminium 911R, entirely out of aluminium. And that's the car that I drove. It was the prototype. The 911R, its greatest achievement was winning the Marathon de la Route, the 84-hour race at the Nürburgring, which I think we've talked about on this podcast before.
Quite recently, yeah.
Quite recently. So we won't dwell on that. But it was an ultra-light, it's still, to this day, the lightest 911 that there's ever been. And although 911s had been racing pretty much since 911s had been around, this was the first car that Porsche had built with competition in mind. And it was, it was just the ultimate. It had a full race engine in it. So the same engine that they were putting in things like the 906 prototype. So I'm trying to remember. I think it was still a 2-litre, but it would have had... 200 and a bit horsepower, twin plugs, heads, and everything else. It weighed, I think, under 800 kilos. It was, it was unbelievable. And the car certainly lived, and I think probably still does in the UK. And I drove it at Brands Hatch. The owner, who lives, certainly then, maybe still, lived in central London, drove it to Brands Hatch. And we had the full, I can't remember why, but we had the full Grand Prix circuit. And the noise this thing made. It sort of sounded like a Lancaster bomber. It sounded completely different to what I expected. I thought it to be this little scream. It didn't. It had this sort of deep, and it was quite intimidating, because obviously it was quite a rare and quite a valuable car. But I just went hoofing it around. I just had just an absolute ball. And it just felt different to any other 911 I've driven, I guess because it was just so unbelievably light. And nimble and agile. And
wow.
It was an incredible machine.
So that was that must have been the first 911 with real motorsport style engineering.
From Porsche, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And you think about all the road-going 911s that have some sort of track... focus, GT3s, GT3 RSs, The very first RS, the 2.7 of 73, they all owe something to the 911R, don't they?
They do. Yeah,
lighter, more power, more focus. Yeah,
yeah, and we're going to do competition in another podcast. But you know, it was after that that Porsche suddenly started thinking, actually, we can really, really leverage this car and get it to do stuff for us. So you know, 911R comes out in 67, wins the Marathon de la Route, 68, is winning the Monte Carlo Rally. That wasn't an R. That was a T. That was the base spec car.
Yeah, which
was really, really clever. We'll get back to this, but yeah, they used the T because it was, you know, they had to homologate a car. The T was because it had nothing on it, because it was the poverty spec car.
Mm.
It was the lightest.
The light one, yeah.
It was the light one. So they called it a T, but it had, I suspect, didn't have a part in common with a normal T, but there you go.
So I've just mentioned the 2.7 RS. Now, would you have, what's more special in your eyes, the 911R or the 2.7 RS?
Oh, the R.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the 2.7 RS was a wonderful, I mean, it was a true homologation special. Again, I've been lucky enough to drive a couple of them. And they're beautiful. They're wonderful. And that 2.7 engine revving round to 7,000 RPM, beautiful steering, fully sorted car, beautifully behaved, looks incredible, you know, with the ducktail, the Burzel spoiler, all of that sort of thing. Great car. But you know, come on, the 911R, first ever competition Porsche, that light means such, I can't remember how they made, but it was like, I don't know, 25? I mean, tiny, tiny numbers. The 911R to me, in some regards, I guess because it's the lightest 911, it's one of the very rarest 911s there have ever been, is right up there, in my mind, among the most special 911s that there have ever been of any kind.
So you mentioned the 2.7 engine. I haven't driven a 2.7 RS, but I've driven a 2.7 Carrera from, I guess, mid-70s. I don't know if it's exactly the same state of tune, but it's the same engine.
Pretty much.
Yeah, mechanical fuel injection, 2.7.
Yeah.
It's the same power, 210 horsepower.
Yeah.
And it is a gorgeous, gorgeous motor.
Yeah, it is.
It's lovely. It's strong. It's torquey. It revs well. Sounds fantastic. It is a wonderful thing.
What we should get you to do, if you haven't done it, is you need to go and drive something like a 1970 or 71 2.2 911S.
Okay.
Because they're screamers.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, a 2.2 911S, 180 horsepower. If you think of it in terms of specific output, you know, Ferrari weren't getting anywhere near that then. And you go and drive a 2.2 911S because it's so light, and it's, you know, that was one of the very first of the longer wheelbase cars. I think they changed the wheelbase in 69. And you know, they sorted it all out, and to me, you know, these cars tend to hide a bit in the shadow of the 2.7 RS, because the 2.7 RS is, and I can use this word, has become an iconic car.
Yeah.
The production cars, the sort of the normal cars that normal people went to go, they were a two, you know, even something like a 2.4E, E standing for Einspritzen, I think, basically made fuel injected. That was the sort of the mid-spec car. So Porsche tended to make three cars in their sort of standard range. So there was the T, which was the poverty spec car, which had everything taken out of it. And then there was, well, at first it was the L, which became the E when they fuel injected it. And then there was the S, which was the hot one. And even, you know, E's are a 2.4E, 160 horsepower, probably more power, 165 horsepower, I think, so more power than an original 911S. Beautiful, beautiful car. And, you know, more mid-range torque. You had to drive an S really hard to get away from an E, to get away from an E, and so I'm disappearing into 911 geekdom here, aren't I? I can tell. But I just thought, like, you know, it's not often that these cars get a chance to be heard, because it's all here. People think, you know, early 70s 911, and they just see ducktails.
Yes,
And RSRs and all this sort of stuff. The only point I want to make is a normal early 70s 911, if it being an E or an S with a 2.2 or a 2.4 litre engine, they are superb cars.
There we go. Let's sing their praises a little bit then.
Yeah.
So I just want to talk about a couple of other RSs. So we have mentioned the 964 RS quite recently, and I think what you've said about that car is that it's super stiff, and probably works beautifully on smooth German roads or the track.
It's a track car, yeah.
Yeah, but on typical bumpy British B road, it's a bit all over the place.
I found it was when I first drove it, yeah. I just found it got deflected, and it actually spoiled the handling rather than improving it.
Now, what about the 993 RS, a car you know well?
Yes, I was waiting until you bring that up. Yes. For those who don't know, which is I'm sure almost all of you, I used to own a 993 RS, which I sold for a sum of money that I don't think I've ever owned up to anyone how little I sold that car for.
Well, you don't have to tell us what you sold it for, but what might it be worth now?
Well, it's a quarter of a million quid car, isn't it? I don't know. I try hard not to look. There'll be people who know, but I suspect it's a... I mean, particularly that car, which was... It was a beautiful car. So many of those cars got crashed. Mm. And this car, funnily enough, it's still owned by the bloke I sold it to, surprise, surprise, because he's less of an idiot than me. And it was just a really, really lovely, pretty low-spec, standard, uncrashed car. And it happened too. I can remember I went to the ring with it once with two other people who had them. And for reasons I cannot explain, it just went better than the other two. There was a blue car, which wasn't good at all. And there was a red car, which wasn't bad. But my it just flew. It was just such a sweet car. And what I liked about it is, unlike the 964 RS, it was much more user-friendly. It had less... uncompromising suspension, which means you really could, and I did, you know, drive it from home to the Nürburgring, do a couple of days at the ring, come home, do one at Spa on the way home, and get home, and the car would feel as good as it was the day you left. It was a brilliant, beautiful car. And I sold it because me and my brother had this mad idea that we'd go racing. And so we bought a Camaro. So I sold the 911 for a disgraceful sum of money, bought the Camaro, did two seasons of racing, at the end of which I had no money, no Camaro, and no 911. Such was the cost of racing, but, you know, and then children turned up and blew, you know, so that was the end of that.
But you've been there and done that.
I love the 993 RS. I think it's quite like, you know, the one you mentioned earlier, the Gen 2 997 GT3 RS. It's just one of those cars that just hits the sweet spot. It gets that 911 thing that it has to be usable. And if you drive, you know, a modern GT3 RS is unbelievable, but it's a track car. A 964 RS was a track car, but a 993 RS or a 997 Gen 2 GT3 RS, they're just, whatever you do with them, they're just right. There's never an environment in which you think, oh, blimey, well, fine, but I wish I wasn't here. They just work. And that's what 911s are about, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, that really is.
Whatever you do with them, they can somehow just do it. And, you know, and you never find yourself sitting there thinking, oh, gosh, I wish I was in something else, or I wish I was somewhere else. You just, whatever you do, wherever you are, you know, whatever your mood, they just do it. And that's what the best 911s do.
Well, there we go. So that's the story of the air-cooled 911. That's episode one. We are going to do more later on in the year. I think we're probably going to talk about
10 episodes just on the air. We haven't even talked about SCs and Carreras.
I know.
There's so much we haven't gone into, but yeah, we're timing out, aren't we?
There we go. So we'll do water-cooled 911s next, and then we'll do the racing history. Yeah. So there's still so much to get stuck into.
But we're going
to
space them out. We're not going to give them three consecutive 911 podcasts. So keep tuning in, and at some stage we'll come back and do some more.
Yep. So to move things on then, we're now doing What Goes Up, and we're going to talk to Chris from JBR Capital, who can explain to us some of the trends that they're seeing in 2023 so far. Chris, welcome to the podcast. Now, you're here to talk about the trends that JBR Capital is seeing so far in 2023. This is the end of Q1, so it's a good time just to sort of look back at the start of this new year. And figure out what JBR Capital are observing in the marketplace. So, I mean, first of all, is it busy? Is it quiet? What's sort of going on at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the first quarter of 2023 has been very busy. We've seen, as everybody knows, a series of base rate rises, I think 11 or 12 in total, starting from last year and actually most recently Thursday of last week. And that's taken the cost people are paying to finance cars across the whole spectrum, really, not just our sector, which is luxury and performance, even in the consumer space as well. The average price people are paying for vehicles, as people would know at forecourt and online, etc., is more if you're choosing to finance them. And to be honest, as a business, we were never sure how that fast and accelerated rise in interest rates would affect end demand. Would people be spooked by the fact that their monthly payments were higher than they've been used to? But actually, certainly in the sector that we operate in, which is average lender around £75,000 to £80,000, it hasn't suppressed demand at all. I think in most cases, it's kind of the demand is stronger than it was this time last year. So people's willingness to pay a higher interest rate for these cars is definitely there. Demand has been significant. And I think it just shows the resilience of this sector, which is based around passion and a thrill of driving and enthusiasm, that if people have decided they want to buy one of these vehicles, they're going to buy one of them, whether the APR is 7.9 or 10.9% generally. So I think we've been enthused by people's willingness to ride that rate rise curve. And certainly in quarter one, we've done more business in this queue than we did in the corresponding previous year in 2022. So things are moving in the right direction for us, definitely.
I mean, that is amazing. Do you think that an element of it is that people tend to regard what's happening at the moment as being a short-term thing? I mean, we know we've got the government saying they're going to halve inflation by the end of the year. I think most people think it'll come down by more than that. So do you think, I mean, I think most people think this, what we've just had, is the last interest rate rise for a while. And presumably people will be thinking, well, we're into this as a sort of long-term commitment. And over time, it may be a bit of pain in the short term, but I want the car now. Summer's coming up. And, you know, over time, it's going to come down.
Yeah, definitely. I think, look, base rate is now 4.25%, and it might get to 4.5, or it may have plateaued. I think there's a couple of things which are happening. One is that after COVID, people are saying to themselves, do you know what, I'm just going to do it. I've always promised myself this thing, and I'm just going to do it, and you only live once. And actually, if the monthly payment is £150 more than I expected, but I can afford to do that, and my business is doing well, and I'm doing well at work, then I'm just going to do it. So there's definitely a period after COVID that says, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And we've seen that. And we've seen people chop and change out of cars probably a bit more than they used to. They'll own something for 6 months and go and get something else. I do think that because people are aware that rates have hopefully nearly reached their peak, that actually, well, I might as well get on now because it's not going to get significantly more expensive for me to do so. So I'll get on now and see what happens. So I think there's a couple of things happening. I think manufacturers are starting to produce more cars again. So there are more cars coming into the market. Obviously, some of the production issues which happened during COVID helped stop those cars coming into the market. But now they're coming back again. That picks everything up. It means the new car supply is more, it is faster, which means the used supply is moving quicker as well. So I do think there's more cars around, and obviously manufacturers are doing their best to get people driving these vehicles. But it's a combination of things. But the resilience of the market, I think we're particularly pleased by, because since we started the company in 2015, actually we've not had to go through this significant rate rise cycle. And, you know, base rate during COVID was 0.1%, and now it's gone up to 4.25. But the appetite for people to purchase these cars on a very accelerated trail remains. So I do think it's a combination of things. But the COVID, I only live once, I'm going to do this while I can, there's definitely that sentiment still in the market.
And do you see seasonality with the cars that people are financing through you? So, you know, we've just come through winter. Are you seeing more SUVs and four-wheel drive cars, and then come spring and summer, are you going to see more convertibles, more sports cars? Does it happen that way?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you'd see that in any part of the sector, but we see it as well. Seasonality wise, obviously we get peaks in March and September. We do very limited new car sales. I think 90% used, 10% new for JBR. But obviously the increase in new car sales in those 2 months spikes the used market, so we're busy. But you do see things in the winter. You see Defenders and Range Rovers, and on the more luxury side, you get Urus's and Bentaygas and Cullinans. And, you know, during the winter months and in the summer, as you expect, you see more traditional sports cars. You see people purchasing GT3s and GT4s and in the Porsche world. And then you see more convertible cars picked up as well. So people are massively driven by seasonality, both in when cars are registered, but what the weather's doing as well.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. They always say, don't they, that if you want to buy a convertible, wait till winter because demand is going to be suppressed and you'll get a better price.
Yeah, exactly. And And, you know, the people that tend to finance with us, I'm always pretty clear on this. These are cars that everybody wants, but nobody needs. So it's a passion asset. You're choosing to have one of these cars. And you might, during the summer when the weather is better, choose just to have a convertible for 3 or 4 months. And then you might trade it back out in September or October for a more conventional, you know, road-going, everyday car. So the people that tend to finance with us are doing it because they're passionate about the cars. They've always had that car they wanted to own. And if they can do it for 5 or 6 months while the weather's good, they normally make the choice just to do it because, you know, that's what they care about. It's what they're passionate about. It's their hobby. Buying cars, driving cars, experiencing them, having that pride of ownership is what really drives them.
Well, as I'm sitting here now, I can see the sun is shining outside. We're almost into April. The weather's going to be improving. Maybe I'll be having a look at what convertible I can get into this spring. Chris, thanks for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. See you soon.
What Goes Up is sponsored this week by car finance specialist JBR Capital. We've been working with JBR Capital for a while now, and it's been a brilliant partnership for us. High-end car finance is all the company does, meaning it understands the car market and car buyers better than most. So before you buy your next sports car, supercar, classic car, luxury car, even a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Visit jbrcapital.com or click the link in description. And this bit is important. Tell them the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. So we've got a listener question coming up, and it is 9/11 themed to suit the topic of this episode. But before that, please remember to rate and review the podcast. And actually, more importantly, hit the follow or subscribe button. It takes seconds to do, and it really, really helps us. So whichever app you're using to listen to this, please hit follow or subscribe. So the listener question comes from Chris Allen, and he says, how has the 911 been so successful in motorsport and on the road for so long when ultimately it's fundamentally flawed by its weight distribution? Now, that's something we sort of touched on earlier on, wasn't it? And the fact is, from a physics point of view, having all that weight out the back where it's a pendulum trying to rotate the car is all wrong. But the 911 has been so successful.
I mean, well, in competition, It is, but the disadvantages of it, you can mitigate, seriously mitigate. And the advantages, you know, it's not as if the layout from a competition point of view is not without its advantages. Anybody driven a 911 will tell you on a track, they come out of corners like a cork out of a bottle. And your speed down any given straight it tends to be determined by the speed at which you come out the previous corner. And if you're in a car, which, because it has so much traction, allows you to get back on the power that much earlier, you're going to come out the corner that much quicker, you're going to go down the straight that much faster. It's as simple as that. And so the layout is flawed, but it's actually nothing like as flawed from a competition point of view as, you know, in your head you might think. You know, it has other advantages too. You know, the flat formation gives you a very low center of gravity. You haven't got, you know, a big fat engine getting in the way of the airflow at the front. And you know, it's, you know, you have light steering. It does just work for a load of different reasons. And the things that makes it not work, you can, and Porsche have, largely engineer your way out of. Which they have done, as we discussed in the podcast, it took them some time to do it. But the disadvantages you can get rid of while at the same time maintaining the advantages. And it's probably technically, ultimately, not quite as good as a mid-engine car. But the differences are not so great that, you know, the engineers have not been able to find their way around them.
And the 911 has always been, relatively speaking, a light and compact car, hasn't it? Compared to a lot of the opposition, and compact, which really helps, and light. But actually, it is interesting that with the latest RSR, Porsche put the engine in the middle.
Yes.
So, yeah. You know, even Porsche determined that there is a balance advantage in shifting, spinning the engine around and putting it in the middle of the car.
Ultimately, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And the funny thing is the efforts that Porsche has had to go to, particularly with the Cayman, to make sure that it's never quite as fast as a... If you look at a GT4 RS Cayman and a GT3 911, you think, well, essentially they've got the same engine. And yet a GT3 is like 9 seconds quicker around the ring. Mm. And then you look at all the things that they give the 911 but don't give the Cayman, just to make sure that that differential is maintained. Mm. I won't get into them now, but they are very different cars.
Yeah. Well, there you go, Chris. Thanks for your question. Keep your questions coming across, and we'll do another next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.